Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently.
And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Dr. Saifedean Ammous for this incredible conversation.
Dr. Saifedean Ammous is an internationally best-selling economist and author. In 2018, Saifedean authored The Bitcoin Standard, The Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking, the best-selling book on Bitcoin, published in 36 languages. In 2021, he published The Fiat Standard, The Debt Slavery Alternative to Human Civilization. Saifedean teaches courses on the economics of Bitcoin and economics in the Austrian school tradition on his online learning platform, Saifedean.com, and he also hosts the Bitcoin Standard podcast. Saifedean was a professor of economics at the Lebanon American University from 2009 to 2019. He holds a PhD in sustainable development from Columbia University, a master's in development management from the London School of Economics, and a bachelor in mechanical engineering from the American University of Beirut. Saifedean, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, sir. How are you?
I am very good. Thank you so much for having me, Sid. Always a pleasure to be chatting to you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you back on the show. You know, honestly, your three books are tremendous. In between the shows, the last time I got to see you, I didn't get to spend a lot of time with you, was at your Bitcoin Standard Carnivore Dinner in Miami, which, to be honest, was one of the best Bitcoin events I'd ever been to, and probably some of the best steak I've ever had at a restaurant, and definitely the first time I know of that I had picanha. And that's been a staple at the family house since then. So thank you for that. You were quite the host. You were signing tons of books. And speaking of signing, you know, when I got the Bitcoin Standard, I was kind of new on my journey. And I saw it as, you know, the ultimate and This is to no way diminish it, but you know, the ultimate graduate textbook on Bitcoin in a way. You know, you kind of, it's not only for graduates, but I sort of, you know, the way I was thinking about it is like, this is my, you know, my educational journey of Bitcoin, and this is the pinnacle book. And, you know, it's way more than, you know, a college textbook or anything like that. But the first one I bought, and I bought a few copies for myself to give away, I didn't get a chance to get signed or anything like that. And I'm not really someone who's like looking for another person's signature, but I want to get into this for a second. So you wrote in your first book, to my wife and daughter who gave me a reason to write, and to Satoshi Nakamoto who gave me something worth writing about. But you know, after I read that book and got to know more of your work, I was in a rush to get the second one. I wasn't sure that a second book by anyone could impress me as much as a book like The Bitcoin Standard. But honestly, maybe The Fiat Standard is even better. It's an incredible piece of work. And in that book, you wrote to my mother, sister, brother, and grandparents. And I did get this one signed by you. And again, I didn't necessarily want, you know, to Cedric or something like that. But I got it to my children, to Boaz. And you wrote to Boaz and Aviva with my best wishes for the Bitcoin future. And for Principles of Economics, I also got that one signed. You wrote in the book to my father, who taught me the most important lesson of this book before I could read, and to my son, so he too may learn it. And I didn't know you had written that, and I don't even know if I remember I got the second one signed, but I got this one signed as well. And I was thinking low time preference myself, and I had this one you wrote to Boaz with my best wishes for a peaceful and prosperous future. So I appreciate, you know, you writing that to my kids, and I love what you wrote to your family and how you kind of kept that in perspective right away. Also, the books, I mean, especially the third one from the Safe House, I mean, it's beautiful. It's crafted like remarkably well. So I just want to thank you for all that and kind of get into it a bit. But I'll leave it to you for any comments on, you know, sort of what I said there and just, you know, I really appreciate it. And maybe what has it been like running the Safe House?
Well, thank you so much, first of all. We'd appreciate your attention to detail with your questions always. I think I put a lot of thought into these dedications, and with Principles of Economics, it seems a little cryptic because it says the most important lesson in this book. And so it's not easy to figure out what lesson is he talking about, and you can't just find a page where you can go and figure out what the lesson is. You have to kind of read the whole thing. And it's another one of these ways in which I could try and grip the reader. Like, what is he talking about? And why did his dad teach him that? And why does he care about his son learning it? I guess I better sit down and read these 420 pages so I can figure it out. And so if you fell for it, congratulations. You've been had. But I hope the payoff was worth it. I think I think the lesson is quite an important one. Should we spoil it for the readers? Might as well, right? Spoiler alert. And this is something I remember my father teaching me this ever since I was a child, which is the one person that you always want to be better than you is your child. And in fact, you not only want it to be better than you, but this is really what matters to you in life. Success in life is having a child and giving them a life better than the one that your parents gave you. And that's it. And it always seemed interesting and curious that my dad would say that. And, you know, as a child, you think that it obviously gives you a lot of reason to pause and think about it. Well, why is this person, there's a fully grown adult who can do all kinds of fun things with his life. Why does he care so much about me? And why does my existence, you know, my existence at that point is centered around ice cream and football and very ridiculous things. Whereas this surgeon, you know, this grown surgeon who saves people's lives for a living every day is out there telling me that I am so important to him that I have to be better than him in order for his life not to be a failure. And you don't quite get it, but you keep thinking about it. And then eventually you start to get it. And what really helped me get it was when I started getting into Austrian economics and getting the Misesian approach to understanding economics, to thinking about society, thinking about civilization. And that's It's, of course, extremely profound, extremely life-changing, and extremely useful. And one of the important things about it, and then this is the theme that runs through this book, you could call this book, it's a the civilizational manifesto. It's a manifesto for human civilization. It's making the case for human civilization, effectively presenting the argument that we cannot have civilization without capitalism, without a free market monetary system, without a free market, without the ability of people to engage with one another consensually, not coercively. And I present, I build up to this. I don't start off making this as a claim and then deduce things from it. I do it the other way around, which is that I start from scratch. We think about human beings acting to economize. How do human beings economize? So they economize through all these ways in which they make their life better. And then first we discuss individual economizing. Then we bring in economizing within the context of society. And then we have people interacting with one another. And then you realize the only way that that can be made to work and to scale is for people to engage with each other based upon the principles of respecting each other's property right, respecting each other's right to property in self and objects that people legitimately own. And there are ways of understanding what is legitimate property. Legitimate property is something that you make yourself from things that nobody else has a claim to, or things that you acquire from others legitimately when they willingly give them to you. And so if you think of that as your algorithm for how to deal with society, you're able to deal with humanity. You're able to engage in a large division of labor, which ends up giving us so many wonderful and amazing things. And it makes us so much more powerful than we could ever be than if we were alone. And so one example that I give, a 10-year-old girl with access to the division of labor can have access to a gun with which she can kill the strongest man in the world, the absolute strongest monster who could rip apart 20 men in a fight. A 10-year-old girl can kill him because she has access to the division of labor, which can manufacture a gun, which she can, whose trigger she can pull and she can kill the man. So being able to engage in civilization, being able to be part of the division of labor is our superpower as human beings. It is the thing that is the most powerful. And it puts all of our abilities on amplify. It amplifies them enormously, and it makes us so much more powerful. And the way to do that is to develop a civilized manner of dealing with others and also of thinking of the future. We cannot have civilization if we have a high tide preference, if we're only considering today and only thinking about our satisfaction now and only thinking about how to meet our daily needs. And so you need to think long term. And then, you know, you come at this from the perspective of Austrian economics. You get into economics thinking that you're looking into money and you're trying to understand how money works and how you can make money. And then you find yourself down the Austrian rabbit hole and you've unlocked and uncovered the secrets to human civilization. And it turns out that the secret to human civilization is the ability of people to think long term. And the thing that gives people the ability and the incentive to think long term because of how we're biologically wired is having children. And so when we have children, we develop this long-term perspective and we start thinking about life, not just in the context of our day-to-day needs, but also our future needs and the future needs of our children. And then once you understand that, you realize effectively what the process of civilization is the process of improving our material conditions. Living in a way that allows us to improve our material conditions requires us to be civilized human beings. So in order for us to be civilized, and I mean that in all of the term, in all of the ways in which the term is used. So you're civilized if you are able to deal with other people respectfully, without aggressing against them, without taking their stuff, without being a thief, without being an aggressor. You're civilized if you have good manners and even table manners. And all of these things, you know, conflict obviously is more important than table manners, but all of these things lead in the same direction, which is minimizes your chances of getting killed today, increases your chances of living longer. And so it allows you to economize for a longer perspective, for a longer period, and it allows you to have a more long-term perspective on life. And having children is key to that. And having children allows you to see the world in a very different perspective. Once you have children, you immediately start to think much more long-term about things. And that's when it began to dawn on me that this really was the same thing that was that my dad had told me ever since I was a little child, that he thinks of his life as being successful if he manages to give me a better life. And that's exactly what civilization is. If we're able to live in that manner, then we are able to accumulate capital over time, and we're able to have each successive generation living at a better living standard than the previous one. And having humans living in this way with better standards every generation, it might seem like it is, superficial. It might seem like it's shallow, but it really isn't. Because better living standards mean better chances of survival, means lower chances of your child dying as an infant, lower chances of people starving to death. And it also means it's not just important for the material goods that it allows us. As you get into this civilization game, and you realize it's also important for the way it allows us to live. In other words, it's not just the destination, it's the journey. Once you're able to live as a civilized human being, you are free from conflict. You are free from dealing with barbarian people who are constantly putting you in conflict. And that's something to aspire to, because it makes life so much better than if you're living a miserable existence of day-to-day conflict and day-to-day fights. And in this book, you know, I make the case for why capitalism is a good thing, why civilization is a good thing, why we shouldn't be apologetic about it, and we shouldn't entertain this kind of subversive Marxist idea that all of this stuff is empty, silly, shallow, materialist nonsense, and we shouldn't care about it, and we should instead believe in all of these ideals that allow us to break the basic building blocks of civilization, which is not initiating aggression, not respecting private property, not respecting people's rights to live their life as they see fit. Because, and I keep, you know, I illustrate this perspective from various points throughout the different chapters, but ultimately, the alternative to civilization is that we end up sliding back to the jungle. There's no way around this. So a lot of people like to say that, you know, we are not fans of civilization. We don't think that capitalism is a good thing. We don't want to be part of capitalism. All of these people are completely hypocritical. They do this. They say this stuff on the internet. You can't get on the internet without an extremely elaborate division of labor that involves millions of people all over the world working together to produce the machines that you're using, to produce the servers that you connect to put the content online that you're engaging with. For you to be able to go there and say capitalism is bad, you cannot do that without resorting to the tools of capitalism. And that's why it's, I say that in the book, I say that the only way in which you can actually seriously be not a hypocrite while criticizing capitalism is if you are doing that with nothing more complex than shouting. Anything that involves utilizing any machine that is more complex than what you are able to make with your own hands is, even making machines with your own hands arguably is capitalism. And so if you want to, if people will say civilization, civilized behavior, non-aggression principle, libertarianism, all these things are naive. We are smarter than that. We believe in violence in the pursuit of the right things. And that's idiotic nonsense from children who don't understand how their world works. It's as idiotic as the child who sits in the back seat driving a fake plastic steering wheel and thinks he's actually driving the car. It just keeps you busy while the car is being driven. But everything in your life, you may justify the initiation of aggression in a certain context, and the vast majority of people justify it. The vast majority of people aren't really anarchist libertarians, so they'll think, yes, I think we should be legitimate to throw people in jail if they smoke weed or if they do this or if they do that. All these non-aggressive things that people could do, you believe legitimate initiating aggression against them. Or, you know, stealing people's land or stealing people's property or taxation or whatever it is. All these things are forms of aggression. And if you think that they are legitimate, well, that doesn't mean that you believe that property rights are invalid, because that's just one tiny little part of your existence in which you're being a hypocrite. But for 99.99% of your life, everything that you rely on, the food that you eat, the computer that you use, the everything that you consume is produced thanks to the system of property rights and the division of labor, which is capitalist civilization, which is what I discuss. And if you were to truly try and stop being a hypocrite and try and disengage from that and try and see how it works out for you, your only option is that you are going to be left in the jungle. And the most effective weapon that you have is flinging your own feces at other people. Because even making an arrow, a spear to throw at people is capitalism. You know, you're taking time away from consumption and you're spending it on producing a weapon, and that's capitalism. You're sacrificing present enjoyment and to build a tool that would increase your productivity into the future. So if you really want to stick it to the capitalists, I'm afraid you're going to have to do it in the jungle on your own.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, especially at the end with decivilization. And the book has a phenomenal arc to it. And this is an incredible piece of work. It took me several weeks to get through it. And I mean that because I had to digest a lot of it, and a lot, it's very sticky. And I have to reread a lot of it over and over. It's incredibly clear and articulate. I'm reading it over and over because there's so many ideas packed into it. And what I'm getting at there is it goes way beyond what I think most people's impressions are of economics, because the book touches on family. And in my interpretation of the book, that gets into, there's a lot of morality in here and values. And when I thought about, you know, I don't necessarily have a human except a hero, except for maybe my dad who recently passed away. And when you're talking about sort of like you want your son to be better than you, this is, you know, I think in some ways you've written these books in reverse, where I would want my son to read this one first to just completely balance him and ground him in the worldview of what's going on here and civilization. And I think even a book like this at his age could help him maybe get through junior high and high school and sort of understand these systems and the way people sometimes act out and are not civilized and why they might be and how they might be interpreting those incentives and signals in society. His book gets into a lot about society and really helps you understand human nature. And there's a lot of psychology in here. Part of it, what I found amazing, though, is the book is easy reading, but it feels factual. And yet, it took me about a third of the way into the book to realize, like, you were lacing and eviscerating arguments everywhere. And it took me a while to pick up on it, because you just read it like, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. That makes sense. That makes sense. And then you start like, wait a minute, he slipped something in there. That's a little bit, you know, he got him there. That's a zinger. And it's like, but it's just grounded and it makes total sense. And why would someone think like that? So it's a remarkable piece of work. I want to kind of start a little bit in the beginning. We talk a lot about, like, you know, economize and sort of, you know, try to figure out how to spend more time on Earth and make that time on Earth better. But just in terms of maybe value, what is the water diamond paradox?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with a nice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, so the water diamond paradox is kind of a watershed moment in the history of economics. Before marginal analysis, before economists invented marginal analysis and started analyzing things marginally, this was how everybody made fun of economists. Everybody would say, well, you can't explain why water is so much cheaper than diamonds, even though we would die if we didn't have water, whereas nobody would die without diamonds. So diamonds are non-essential. You don't need them to survive. And yet people pay thousands of dollars for a few grams of diamonds, whereas water is essential. We would die if we didn't have water for a few days. And yet people pay very, very little money for many kilograms of water that they consume every day. And so that doesn't seem to make sense, because if you think about it in terms of valuation, well, if I asked you, what do you value more? If I told you that for the rest of your life, you can only have diamonds or water, what are you going to choose? Obviously water, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, clearly. And so that was a bit of a puzzle. But then Karl Menger comes up with the idea of marginal analysis. And that's what really set economics straight, because it allowed us to answer this question and understand why it is that people pay more money for diamonds, even though if you ask them, they'll tell you water is more valuable. And the reason is that people don't ever have to pay money for a good in the abstract. Nobody is ever put in this kind of choice where I put a gun to your head and I tell you water or diamonds for the rest of your life, because I don't have you in a prison where I can subject you to that choice and then make sure that you never get any water or diamonds. For the vast majority of us, that choice is going to be taken in the real world. We're going to be out there and we're deciding not between all of the world's diamonds and all of the world's water. We're deciding between the next unit of diamond and the next unit of water, given our current circumstances. Now, the vast majority of people that are in any kind of position for you to be asking them that kind of question are people who are not starving, who are not dying of thirst, and who need water, but they already have an enormous amount of water available to them. So how much water do you consume today? Well, you've probably showered and your dishwasher has done your dishes for you. Maybe you got your car washed. Maybe you, some people have swimming pools at their home. So most likely you've spent more than 100 liters of water in a day. And that's, I think, kind of a lower average estimate between what you drink, what you use for cooking and washing and so on. So given that you have 100 liters of water, and I'm asking you about an extra cup of water right now versus a cup of diamonds, well, that cup of water is just an extra cup over the 100 liters that you've consumed today. Whereas very, very few people in the world have a cup of diamonds. And so that would be your first cup of diamonds. In fact, for the majority of people in the world don't have diamonds. And for the majority of people, if you told them about a diamond, it would be their first diamond. So the choice then is never between water and diamond in the abstract. The choice between the next unit of water, usually that is a unit of water after having already consumed many units of water to the point where the next marginal unit doesn't matter so much for you, versus the next marginal unit of diamond, which, given that diamonds are so rare and scarce, is usually very small, is usually very early in the number of goods that you have. So it's either your first diamond or your second diamond. And that's why we can see that in this situation, people end up paying a lot more money for diamonds, because that diamond is their first diamond. You know, when you buy a diamond to propose to a woman, incidentally, I strongly recommend against it. Don't make my mistake. diamonds are a scam. They can make fake diamonds that are indistinguishable from real diamonds. But it's a cartel that keeps it going. But I mean, the same analysis applies for gold or silver. They are more expensive than water. But you know, if you're buying your first diamond so that you want to get married, I mean, this is going to be something that you are willing to spend significant amounts of money on, because the bigger the diamond, the more impressive it is to the woman that you're proposing to, the more it indicates to her that you are willing to put resources forward for this marriage, for this relationship. And well, the idea behind gold usually was that you'd give her gold so that she could have it, and that if something happens to you, she can always sell the gold and she'll be fine. Diamonds sort of try to recreate that, but then people try and sell their diamonds and they realize what a scam it is, because usually the resale market is very low. But in any case, the important point here is the marginal analysis. The important point is that people are talking about the first diamond, and so for the first diamond, you're willing to pay a lot. Now, after you've had, you know, imagine you end up in a situation where you have thousands of diamonds. You've accumulated thousands of diamonds because you managed to find a diamond mine under your house, and every morning you hop into the mine and you come up with 5, 10 diamonds. And now your house is full of diamonds. You eat in plates that are encrusted with diamonds, and your laptop is encrusted with diamonds. And then in that situation, you're likely going to want to pay not a lot of money for the next diamond that I offer you. Now, imagine that's your situation, but also you are stuck in an island where you have all these diamonds, but you don't have any water. And now you don't have any water to drink. And I'm sitting there with a cup of diamonds and a glass of water. And I'm asking you, how much would you pay for this glass of water now? Well, now the water becomes much more expensive than the diamonds. So what matters really is the time and the place where we're making the choice about the next unit. And that's what determines the price. So when you say the price of diamonds is, say, $1,000 per gram of diamond or whatever it is, whereas the price of water is less than a cent per gram, or less than a tenth of a cent maybe per gram, that is in the context of you're taking that decision on the margin, at the margin, in a modern society with a plentiful abundance of water and a dearth of diamonds. So people are deciding between the 100th unit of water of the day and the first diamond of the year, or the millionth unit of water in a year versus the first diamond of the year, or the first diamond of the decade, or something like that. Whereas if you switch things around, you put us in a context where there's no water, but there's a lot of diamonds, then the valuation becomes different. So prices are not set in stone. Value is not objective. Things don't come with a price tag built into them. And it's not something that everybody agrees upon. It's something that every person makes as a subjective valuation at a particular point in time. Everybody values things at every point in time when they see them, depending on all kinds of circumstances. And one of the most important ones is the relative scarcity or abundance, or the marginal utility that you have with respect to how much of the good that you have. And so the more that you have of a good, the more the marginal utility diminishes. The value you attach to the next unit declines. It doesn't mean that you don't value having it. It's just that you have value having the 10th unit less than you value the 9th and the 8th and the 7th and the 6th. And that's true for pretty much everything. So the first cup of water is the difference between life and death for you. The 50th cup of water allows you to make your shower a little bit longer. And so, yeah, you value that. You appreciate a few extra seconds in the shower, but you don't value it as much as life and death.
Yeah. Along those lines, speaking of sort of scarcity and a cup of water, from humanity's perspective, and maybe even from one human's perspective, is there anything truly scarce in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that I make in this book, and this is sort of original for me, it's not something that the Austrians generally make, and I think, but I think it fits very well within the Austrian perspective. So within the Austrian perspective, economic goods are scarce, resources are scarce, and so human beings are always economizing, and that is true because they are scarce. We don't have unlimited Ferraris, we don't have unlimited diamonds, we don't have unlimited food. All of these things need to be produced, but There are, I like to make this distinction, I make this in the Bitcoin Standard first, the distinction between things that are relatively scarce, which are all of these things, diamonds, food, cars, homes, all of these things are relatively scarce because we can always make more of them if we just dedicate more time toward making more of them. But one thing is absolutely scarce, in my opinion, is human time, because that is the one thing that we cannot just indefinitely make more of. So yeah, you can stay healthy and live a little bit longer, but as far as reliable stories go, it does not look like we have any reliable way of increasing the human lifespan beyond 120 years or so. And so think of that as the upper bound, and that's it. Then there's nothing you can do to extend that beyond that. There's a, and one day you're going to be dying. It's unfortunately true for all of us. And until then, you don't even know when that's going to happen. So you get born and you might die a second after you're born, or you might die 120 years, or you might die any day between those 2 days, 120 years apart. So we have this uncertainty attached to life, and we have this ticking clock, or this, you know, the sand watch, where the grains of sand are just going down, and you never know when the grains of sand stop trickling down. And so that's, in my opinion, the one thing that is truly scarce, because from that thing, which is time, we can make more of everything else. And so this is where I bring in the work of Julian Simon, who's not really an Austrian economist, but he is a free market economist, Chicago economist. And I think his work complements the Austrians quite well, because what he introduces is, well, he explains how, yeah, there is a physical limit to how much of all of these physical resources exist on Earth, because the Earth itself is finite. But really, the Earth is just so absolutely enormous compared to what we consume that it's completely meaningless for us to be discussing just how much of these resources exist on Earth. It's like an ant walking into a Walmart and thinking, oh boy, is there going to be enough food for me? I mean, you could continue to eat forever, for all of your lifetime. You could have 1,000 ants and 1,000 lifetimes, and they still wouldn't run through a tiny fraction of all the food that is in this giant convenience store. So the limit on how much we can consume of those things is not how much of them exists in the crust of the Earth. The limit is how much we dedicate from our time toward producing those things. So the more time we spend on making oil, the more oil we have. The more time we spend on making Ferraris, the more Ferraris we have. There is no real ultimate scarcity to those things. There's no upper bound on how many Ferraris or how much gold or how much oil or how much gas, how much nickel, copper, any of those things. There's no upper bound on how much of all of those things we can accumulate or produce, because all it requires is just dedicating more time to it. We could triple the production of anything if we just dedicate more time to it and take time away from everything else. And the reason we don't do that is because other things are also scarce. So we could triple copper production, but we don't, because if we tripled copper production, we'd have a lot more copper, great, but we'd have a lot less iron, a lot less gold, we'd have a lot fewer Ferraris. And so given that gives us a very good framework of understanding how we are economizing. It's not that these things are scarce because there's not enough of them. It's that our time is scarce because there's not enough of it. There's only so many of us, and each one of us only has so many hours in a day. And so we need to economize between all of those choices, and we need to figure out whether my time is more productively spent digging for oil or making sandwiches or manufacturing cars or building laptops or coding software or all of these infinite amounts or infinite number of jobs that we could be doing. We economize between them by doing the math, essentially, by performing economic calculation on the valuation that we attach to all the outputs of those things. And I discuss it in the context of an individual economizing for himself, where you think about whether I should work or I should enjoy myself. But then when you are in a society, it's no longer about you producing for yourself about the things that you want. no longer you thinking about the evaluation of things. You are in a market economy, and then your incentive is to produce for other people. And so you're out there looking at prices, trying to calculate the most effective way to produce for others. And that's what we do as economizing. And that helps us understand how the market system emerges out of people's own valuations, out of people's own economic calculation, and out of people's attempts to improve their own well-being.
Yeah, I think the other analogy you draw in the book is how, you know, if Earth's resources was an Olympic-sized swimming pool filled with water, and water representing every resource on Earth, and what if we pulled out maybe an 8-ounce cup of water from this pool, which, yeah, it, you know, half a cup, and that's what happens maybe in evaporation per second back and forth into the atmosphere through osmosis. So it's like negligible. It's like scientifically unreadable. When you looked at minimum wage and its impact on sort of unemployment, what relationship did you draw there? Does, you know, raising minimum wage eliminate unemployment? Is there that sort of relationship that we're taught?
No. So I use this as my first kind of object lesson in order to try and illustrate the difference between the way in which we discuss these things from the Austrian perspective and from the mainstream Keynesian perspective that's taught at universities. So in universities, I think the Austrian approach is characterized by looking at things through the lens of human action. And this is why it fits in so well with the discussion that I was having earlier about Simon's view on time. Because from the Austrian perspective, everything is made by human beings. Human beings are what act. The only force, the only causal force in economics is humans and human action, what human beings do. And I think a good way of thinking of it is that everything else is just putty. It's like Play-Doh. And then we turn that Play-Doh into all of these amazing things around us. So we don't come into Earth with laptops, cars, buildings pre-installed. Earth is just a bunch of rocks and a bunch of living things running around. And then we manage to turn those things into all of these economic goods that we have and all of the economic output that we have. And so from the Austrian perspective, if you want to understand the economics of anything, whether it's the houses or the cars or anything that is an economic object, you have to see the animating force that is driving it and turning it into an economic object. And that force is human beings acting. And so that's the causal element. So we begin the analysis with what did the human being involved do? And then what are the implications of human beings acting? And this infuriates Keynesians because it sounds like it's so trivial and nonsensical. But it's infinitely more powerful than their voodoo, because in their world, all of these material things seem to have agency, seem to have the ability to act on the world on their own. And that's insane, because they don't. And so in macroeconomics, for instance, you have all these equations that attempt to explain how the world works and attempt to explain to you the relationship between all these aggregates that are just purely constructed things. And there's no reason to assume that these relationships hold. There's no reason to assume that there should be a direct relationship between inflation and unemployment, or GDP and unemployment, or any of those things. That if inflation goes up by 3%, then you would expect that unemployment will have to drop by 7% or whatever. There's no reason why any of these relationships should hold. The reason economists like to do that is because they, and recently I've just finished reading The Progressive Era by Rothbard, a great book, I highly recommend it. I mean, it might be a little tedious if you're not so much into American history. It's incredibly detailed in his discussion of it, but it's useful to see where this drive towards scientific management of human society comes along. And it comes from this progressive era. And it's really an outgrowth of religious sentiment, where people just, people became really activist in their religion, trying to bring about heaven on earth. And then that got out of hand. And people just started deifying the state, which was their tool to bring about the heaven on earth. And then they forgot about God, and then they just stuck to the state. And that's what gave us this modern managerial state. And it's what gave us this idea, which in economics, you know, if you read about the way that an economics textbook discusses the state. The state is an omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent being that can just fix things by clicking a button. And the way to arrive at this kind of conception, the way to fool yourself into thinking that you have this amount of power, is to try and recreate the sciences. Because with the sciences, the physical sciences, we can have a very high degree of certainty about the way that we move physical objects, the way that we command and control physical objects. And so this is something that I suffered from when I first got into graduate school, and I think it's an enormously common thing. And this is why I believe everybody in graduate school should read Austrian economics. Everybody should drop out first, but if they don't, then maybe they should really read Austrian economics. It's very important, in my opinion, because it'll help you understand that engineering a car or engineering an airplane is a very different thing from engineering a human society. It's an entirely different problem. And the reason is that the causative element in engineering physical objects are physical objects that don't have consciousness, don't have a brain, don't have a will of their own. Whereas the causal element in human society are human beings who are acting. And so if you're analyzing any economic phenomenon based on the idea that look at these aggregates and here's a relationship between those aggregates, well, you can come up with any relationship you want, and then you can just say we expect it to hold. And then, of course, it's not going to hold in the real world, because the real world doesn't owe you to abide by the equations you pulled out of thin air. And so, therefore, it'll break down. Now, of course, in modern academia, being wrong is not a problem. Not publishing is the only problem. So it doesn't matter. You just publish another paper. You tweak the model to fit the last result. And then next time you're wrong, doesn't matter. You publish another paper. And so you keep on going. So there's no real intellectual honesty here, and there's no real scientific process wherein we test hypotheses, and then if they fail, we reject them. We just constantly amend them until they fail the next time, in which case we amend them on and on and on. So all of this is a very roundabout way to go back to the issue of the main minimum wage, which is, if you read it from a mainstream economics perspective, wherein we just have all of these relationships between those aggregates, then you will find plenty of models in the literature that will tell you if the minimum wage goes up, then you would expect that the lower paid workers will start getting paid more. That's going to result in an increase in aggregate spending. Increased aggregate spending is going to result in more employment, and that's going to result in higher GDP, and then it's going to kickstart a whole virtuous cycle and an economic boom. That's because you're basing it on some baseless theory about how these aggregates will correlate with one another and how they will cause each other to behave. Whereas if you try to base that on sane economics, you would understand that it is human beings that are acting. And you would understand that employment is not something that would just be subject to the whims of the equations that you came up with. It's determined by the individuals who are involved. And it requires a worker, but it also requires an employer. And so when you are raising the wage, the minimum wage, if you decide that you're going to be raising the minimum wage, the actual effect in terms of a human action, if you're thinking about it from the perspective of how human beings are acting, you'll see is that the employer now has a tougher job with being able to employ his employee. Because ultimately, the employer is not out there hiring people willy-nilly. It's not a choice that he takes out of the blue. He doesn't just wake up one day and say, today I want to hire 500 people, tomorrow I'm going to hire 20, and then the next day I'm going to hire 3,000. It doesn't work that way. There's a conscious economic decision, and it's an economic decision based on calculation. With every factor of production that you want to employ, you have to run the numbers and figure out, if I add this thing, how much is it going to add to my revenue? And is that addition more than what it cost me? It's true when you hire a worker. It's true when you buy a new machine. It's true if you're going to move to a bigger headquarters. Whatever factor of production that you're going to bring into the process of production, you have to run the numbers on it, and you have to see if introducing it to the process of production is going to give you more output or less. And if it gives you more, then you're better off. If it gives you less, then you don't go and do it. So this is how you would consider these questions. But unfortunately, And most people don't think of it this way. They think of it in a very Keynesian way. So in the real world, what happens when you raise the wage of a worker? You've made it so that the only workers that can get hired are the ones whose productivity is higher than the minimum wage. And people think of this, of course, emotionally. So there's, on the one hand, there's the shoddy collectivist aggregate of math, which is aping sciences. On the other hand, there's the emotional aspect of it, which is, oh my God, $5 an hour, that's so little. How could you live? How could you have a family on $5 an hour? That sounds terrible. We should raise it to $10 an hour. That makes it much better. And of course, that's just emotional speak. And what actually is happening is that anybody whose productivity is less than $10 an hour now is no longer employable. And you might think the employers are just going to have to raise everybody's wage. But if they raise everybody's wage, they're basically turning their businesses into being unprofitable. So either they are going to have to fire the workers that are not as productive as the $10 an hour, or they are going to have to shut down. They're going to go out of business because they're going to be driven out of business by the people who are not taking such irresponsible decisions. And the really, of course, the really cruel thing about it is the majority of these workers that are hurt by the minimum wage are the workers that are just young and just starting off. And it's okay that they're not getting paid a lot. It's better than going to university in most cases where they're paying tons of money in order to just basically party and do nothing value most of the time. But if instead of going and paying tens of thousands of dollars to a university to waste your time, if instead you got a job that barely paid you enough to just cover the expenses of the job, well, guess what? You do this for a few months, you're going to start getting good at it. And that's going to raise your productivity. And then the longer you do it, the more familiar you are with the work, the more familiar you are with your job, the more skills you acquire, the more discipline, work ethic that you acquire. And that makes you more and more productive. And that's how your wages go up. So the cruel thing about the minimum wage, again, thinking of it through the lens of human action, is that it not only puts people out of work, it also prevents people from developing the skills that would make them employable. It doesn't just create unemployment, it creates a class of unemployable people. Because if you start off with a productivity that is lower than the minimum wage, you're never going to be able to get into a job that would allow you to gain the productivity that would make you beat the minimum wage. And so therefore, you get stuck outside of work, and then that's going to likely drive you toward doing illegal things, wasting your time away in crime or drug dealing or black markets or things like that. And you're not going to develop the work ethic that you'd need in order to get into a real job. And that's what's really catastrophic about it.
Yeah, it's like you make these people illegal to hire, illegal employees. It's a weird phenomenon. And you're boxing them out and you think you're kind of boxing everyone in. I thought all the chapters are illuminating, but especially the one on energy and power was quite insightful. How would you explain the value of manpower, you know, in like the times of kings and slaves? Like, I mean, when I was 20 years old, I could jump in the family station wagon, fire it up, and drive a Blockbuster DVD back to the, or whatever it was, back to the store, you know, using 5,000, you know, horsepower to get there, you know, or 500 horsepower and moving a 5,000 pound vehicle or something. And, you know, I'm not even earning a living, and I'm returning the family DVD back to Blockbuster, versus, you know, what manpower or horsepower, you know, kind of in terms back then.
Yeah, I think a good way of thinking about the economics of power, and this is one of the reasons that I wanted to include this. So, I mean, the book generally hews very close to the Austrian line. It's very similar to Human Action. It tries to take the ideas of Human Action and present them in a way that is more palatable to the modern reader. But it strays away from Austrian orthodoxy, I'd say, into chapter 3, where I introduced the concept of time, and I discussed this earlier about how I frame all of economizing as being about economizing of time, and then also chapter 8, where I bring in energy. And I believe this is, I mean, I dare to say maybe original, maybe somebody else has come up with this. I don't know, because a lot of people write about energy and economics, but I think Bringing in the Austrian marginal analysis to understanding energy and power, I believe, was very insightful toward the end, understanding how energy and power works today. And also, I believe it helps us understand how economics and how economies advance. I think it's important to understand the economics of energy and power in order to understand how the world economy works and how individual economies work. And so, briefly, I'd say the key point, the key insight here is that I don't think it is accurate to use the term energy in a market context or to call energy an economic good. I don't think energy itself is an economic good, because in chapter one and two, in the introductory chapters, I lay the groundwork of what an economic good is. And an economic good is something that offers utility, but it has to have some degree of scarcity that forces you to economize. And so if you are on a river, if you're standing next to a river, water is not an economic, because you can reach into the river and take out as much water as you want at any point in time. You don't have to economize water. But if you are in a situation where water is scarce, then you have to economize it. And you have to value it. You attach a value to it, because then you value it compared to other things. And then you need to start making decisions about how much you allocate from your time and resources toward acquiring the water versus acquiring other things. So it is scarcity that forces us to make valuation. And I argue energy as a concept does not involve, is not a scarce thing. In fact, if you look around, the amount of sunshine that hits the earth every day is more than all the energy that we consume in an entire year. The amount of wind blowing all over the world is more than the energy that we consume. The amount of hydrocarbon fuels that are underneath us that we know of is many, many, many multiples of what we consume. And then, of course, the nuclear power is many, many, many more multiples of everything that we consume. So right now, you're surrounded by energy everywhere around you. The sun is hitting on you. The wind is blowing. There's a waterfall next to you. It's infinite energy. So it's really not an economic good energy itself is not an economic good. But what is an economic good is power. And in thermodynamics and in engineering, the distinction between power and energy is that energy is the force that creates things. Power is the energy over unit of time per second. So power is joules per second. Energy is measured in joules. Power is joules per second. And power is what we need. Power is what allows us to do things. Power is what allows us to get work done. It's what allows us to move things. And so understanding this, that what we're actually economizing for is power. You buy an engine and you buy gasoline because you're able to click a button and then it delivers this propulsion that gets you from point A to point B at a fast period of time. And that's the energy that you care about. All of the energy blowing in from the sun is pointless for you because it's infinite and it can't be directed towards the meeting of your needs. What can be directed toward the meeting of your needs is power, whether it's the sun that's going through the solar panels and then used to give you electricity or whatever it is. But you need to turn it into the form of power. And I think this is very useful in terms of understanding how we can think of the economics of different energy sources. So one of the many common things that you hear about, I think Elon Musk just tweeted this the other day. He's a great proponent of a lot of very bad economic fallacies, as usual. And so he said something along the lines of, oh, well, obviously we're going to switch to solar because the world gets more solar per day than we consume in a year or something like that. And I addressed that in the book. I wrote this before he made this statement. But I address this precisely because of that, because you see this over and over in this rhetoric. And again, it doesn't matter. The absolute quantity, just like the absolute quantity of water and diamonds does not matter, because nobody is having to choose between water and diamond. Nobody has to choose between iron and gold. And nobody has to choose between solar energy and hydrocarbon energy. We got to choose between power, between the amount of power that we can deliver. And when you make the comparison between power, you see why, even after hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars of subsidies over the past five decades, we still can't have solar power economical anywhere without massive government subsidies subsidizing it, and people still want their good old wholesome hydrocarbon engines because they deliver the power when you want it, at the time that you want it, at the exact intensity that you want it, completely independently of the weather. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is to try and think of it, the one that you mentioned is look about how much energy and power we consume as individuals today. If you want to understand just how important energy has been to our life, think about the amount of power that it allows us in terms of the labor that it displaces. And this, I dedicate this section of the book to all the people who worry about technology and machines taking human jobs. Well, every day you are displacing 200 jobs. You could have 200 people around you trying to do the things that you are doing today. And of course, they wouldn't be able to do it if they were trying to replace the machines that you're using. So if you think about when you take a hot shower, that takes a lot of power to make that hot shower. How do you get that power? Well, you can use modern fuels where you have a boiler in your apartment, let's say, and it boils some water and then you shower with the water. And so you have a tiny little bit of fuel that contains a lot of power inside it. And then, that allows you to have the hot water that you desire. Alternatively, you could hire some slaves to go chop down some trees and burn the trees and boil the water. That's another way of doing it. Now, if you really care about employment, if you don't want to put people out of work, then you should definitely hire the slaves and get rid of your boiler. See how that works out for you and them, and see how happy they are going to be taking that job. But of course, your car also, another beautiful example, you could replace your car with a couple of hundred horses or a couple of thousand human beings. But still, I don't think even 1,000 human beings would be able to pull your car as fast as you could do it with a tiny little engine. So what we are able to have today in our modern world because of the use of hydrocarbon, which allows us energy, which allows us high power on demand, anytime, anywhere we want it, because they're highly mobile, is effectively the subjugation of the power of hundreds of people at our fingertips every day. The average person in a civilized country, in civilized industrial society, has effectively something like 200 people's power at his fingertips every day. And historically, the only people who had something like this had to be kings or massively rich people who had an enlarged number of slaves. Other than that, everybody else had to fend for himself. So you wanted hot water, you had to go chop your own wood, bring the wood, and make it. I mean, you could have other people do it, but even if other people did it for you, yeah, there's the division of labor. It makes it more efficient, but you only had your own labor to trade for their labor. So yeah, they can go and chop the wood, but you had to trade that for something. So you had to cook for them or you had to do something else for them. And so you only had your own power to provide every day. And so your measly 50 watts is, I think, the maximum power that you can put in as a cyclist or something like that. And so that amount of power is all that you had going for you to try and meet your needs in any particular day. And now, because of these enormously useful, beautiful sources of power that we are able to utilize, even an average normal person in an industrial society has more power at his fingertips every day than the richest kings in the past. And that's why, I mean, obviously it would be nice to be a king in the past in so many ways, but you could still die from very simple preventable diseases back then. You could still freeze to death even as a king because existence was a lot more precarious without all these beautiful machines that we have.
And thinking about economizing time, kind of maybe, explaining what we see in society, or maybe people just trying to figure out what they want to do with their time in life. Why do doctors make less than a janitor during their first year of residency?
Yeah, that's a good example I bring up on the issue of the minimum wage. So most people think, well, if you're working for minimum wage, then, as I mentioned earlier, you're broke and it's terrible. But pretty much every job, even the highest paying jobs, you start off earning less than minimum wage as a starting level. So if you look at your average doctor, After going through 12 years of school, 4 years of university, 4 years of medical school, and then doing a residency or doing an internship or something like that, I forget. My brother went through the whole thing, but I lost track of it. But for his first job, he was required to work ungodly hours, you know, waking up the middle of the night, staying up for 24-hour shifts or whatever. He was working ungodly hours and he was getting paid very little. And that's true for pretty much all doctors, plus all the time he needs to spend studying for his job. That if you ran the numbers on it, you'll find that there are janitors in his hospital who make more than he does. And yet these kind of residencies attract all of the world's best doctors. They're all out there applying for these residencies when they get out of medical school. Why? Because again, the most important thing that you get from your first job is not the paycheck, it's the experience. So it's true for doctors, it's true for engineers, it's true for lawyers. They start off getting paid very little because if you don't have work experience, you're not worth a lot. And whoever is taking you on is doing you a huge favor by showing you the ropes, basically showing you how the job is done. And so therefore they don't need to pay you a lot. And that's why people line up to get into those prestigious residencies where they go and get paid less than their janitor. Because once you succeed at this, once you go through this whole thing and not kill anyone and show that you can turn up on time and that you are a reliable, dependable, civilized human being, well, then you become enormously, enormously productive and you have an enormous amount of value that you can provide to your future employer. And then you can charge a much higher fee for your next employer. And you see this across all jobs, really. And it's a shame that, I mean, if people really wanted to implement minimum wage laws, they would ruin the, if they implemented them across medicine and law and engineering, they would probably ruin those positions because most people begin with these internships that are getting paid less than minimum wage laws. But the same is true for bartenders, for waiters, for construction workers. All of these jobs, you start off. You are not worth a lot because you're not very productive. But if somebody's taking a chance on you and giving you that job, they're giving you the tools with which you can learn. And so when you make that law, you make it hard for these people to get the experience they need in order to become more productive.
Yeah, I mean, that was illuminating to me. Just kind of a simple explanation of why you see those kind of inversions at times, and maybe people trying to struggle or think to interpret those signals in the economy. Like, I thought this was also fascinating. Who provides the vast majority of security in the world, the public or private sector?
Yeah, this is an interesting tidbit that I came across while reading libertarian anarchist propaganda. Most people think, well, security obviously needs to be a monopoly. Even some very libertarian people, or people who think of themselves as really libertarian, for instance, Randians, objectivists, they think that you need to have followers of Ayn Rand. They think, well, you want to have a free market and everything except for security. You can't have a market in security. Security is special, it's different. But in reality, we already have a market in security. In fact, the vast majority, well, not the vast majority, but far more of the world's security is provided privately than by government. There are more private security guards in the world than there are police. And if you think of the size of the defense industry and the security industry, in fact, it is predominantly privately owned and it's predominantly subject to the same economic system that we discuss in the book throughout, which is the division of labor, capitalist production. So among the 100 largest producers of weapons in the world, I think I forget the exact number, but I have a statistic in the book, but a commanding majority, I would say, is privately owned. And some of them are publicly owned. They are owned by government, but even those companies that are owned by governments, they still only exist within the context of a free market economy in which they buy their inputs and sell their outputs on the free market. To varying degrees, obviously, some of them just sell straight to the government, some of them just buy straight from the government, but still, they exist in a world in which these goods are existing in a market. And so there's private property involved there. And so this is the, you know, one of the kind of, a lot of people who are not very familiar with libertarian thought or with Austrian economics will say, all right, we'll admit it, you guys are right. Minimum wage is bad, price controls are bad, having free markets is good. But I mean, there's a couple of major buts there. There's the first one is the money and banking. So some people will concede that, okay, you don't want the government to intervene too much. You don't want to have price controls. You don't want to have a potato board. You want to leave the potatoes to the free market. They'll concede that. But then they'll tell you, no, but the money in the banks, I said, that's too important. You can't leave it for the market because it's too important. When, of course, it should be the other way around. It's precisely because it is too important you don't want to have a monopoly agency messing it up. And then even if they concede that one, the second layer of cope, of state cope, if you want, is okay, but we need to have the security being provided by the government. And that's something that's just different. And it's the statist conception of the idea that, look, there's a sphere for the market and for civilized and capitalist interaction and free markets and free trade and the division of labor. And then there's the sphere of violence, and the sphere of violence is always going to be there. And that's just idiotic, childish nonsense. Violence is just like any other thing in the world. Protection from violence is an economic good, and it's just like any other good in the world. And there's no reason that this good needs to be provided by a monopolist any more than potatoes need to be provided by a monopolist, any more than books need to be written only by a monopolist, or banking, or money. None of these things require a monopoly for them to function. Of course, the people who do benefit from these monopolies always insist that they do need to be a monopolist and that it is for your own good. But it is not. It's not for your own good that you have a monopoly in these industries. In fact, and we see realistically, in spite of all the brainwashing where people think the government is out there providing security, you see there are more private security guards. Most people rely on for their own security, particularly people who have serious money and particularly businesses. They have their own security. So, and that makes a lot of sense because, and as I do in the book, I break it down as an economic good. And I show why the idea of having a monopolist provide this economic good is unworkable because it falls into the same problem of economic calculation, which I discuss in chapter 12, which is a very pivotal chapter in the book because the glue that holds all of the market system together is the ability of entrepreneurs to perform economic calculation. That's what allows us to have nice things because they can figure out what they can use with what inputs they can use and how they can produce the outputs. And only they can only do that if we have economic calculation, and we can only have economic calculation if we have a form of money that works and doesn't suck. And we can only do that if we have a free market in capital. Because if you take away a free market in capital or a free market in any good, then people aren't able to perform economic calculation. And that's why central planning, socialist central planning fails. A lot of people think the problem with socialism is scale, that it's too large. That's nonsense. Amazon has more employees than Estonia has citizens. And yet Jeff Bezos is able to plan Amazon for 1.5 million employees and something like 300 million customers around the world. It can be centrally planned, but you cannot centrally plan Estonia. The issue is not size. The issue is property rights. In Estonia, if you deny property rights for people, then you're going to end up with a central planner who is unable, no matter how well-intentioned, no matter how smart, no matter how well-informed, he cannot perform economic calculation when there is no market at which the goods are being bought and sold. And if there is no market for the goods to be bought and sold, then there's no way of calculating the best use of particular goods, and then economic production falls apart. That's a key point. And most people who think socialism has been critiqued by economists, they think of the problem of scale, or they think of the problem of incentives. These are irrelevant. These are not the real problem of socialism. Socialism solved the problem of incentives by sending you to the gulag if you don't work. And the size problem has been solved by Jeff Bezos. It doesn't matter. It's not size and it's not incentive. It's calculation. Jeff Bezos is able to calculate because every single tiny little widget that goes into Amazon is bought on the free market with a price. And so he's able to make all of these economic calculations, and all of his subordinates can make economic calculation. And so security is no different. And I think this is a very powerful framework for understanding the issues of security around the world. It's why you can see we arrive at this absurd situation where people normalize it, where they think it's normal. That, yeah, I mean, the average American thinks that the U.S. government is out there protecting him. The average American pays something like a trillion. I mean, the American government pays something like $1 trillion a year for defense. And then if you account all the other expenditures at state and local and federal level for police and all of these things, it must be several trillions of dollars. And yet, kids can't walk in the streets of Chicago. You can't have your kids walk in the streets of Chicago. I mean, just imagine if you had actually had a market handling all of that money, how much security you'd have. You could give every single person in Chicago their own bodyguard on the free market, and it would be a lot safer. So why does it suck? It sucks because there is no calculation. It sucks because it's being done without a property rights system, and it's being done by central planners who do not face real consequences for the choices and the resources that they direct. And so that's why we end up with a system where security as a state institution is continuously failing further and further and becoming less and less reliable and providing less and less security for the people that pay for it. And people are having to just write off the taxes that they pay. Effectively, the best way to think of your taxes is that it's not something that you're paying because it gives you security or it gives you any public facilities or it gives you roads or any of that stuff. Just think of your taxes as the price you pay to stay out of jail. And then your security is something that you have to buy yourself. So you need to hire private security. You need to buy your own gun. You need to have an alarm system. You need to do all of these many, many, many private things that people are doing. And these things are a lot more efficient. And private police are a lot more efficient and a lot more productive because they face tests of the market, because they have to perform economic calculation. When I used to teach at university, I'd always ask students, how many times have you been harassed by a cop? And there'd always be a couple of students who'd raise their hands. And then I asked them, how many times were you harassed by a private security contractor at this university's security or in the shopping mall or any of that stuff? Nobody ever raised their hand. There's never been in my class, I'm sure it's happened sometime, but not in my classes, not in my students. I've never had an example of somebody say, a girl saying, yeah, I got harassed by one of the university's private security guards. Whereas a lot of police harass women. A lot of police harass men and women, not just women, but it happens all the time. Because there is no logic and there is no economic calculation that goes into the hiring decisions of people in the defense industry when it is hired by government. So, and you don't have to, it doesn't have to invoke ill intentions or incompetence. It's just impossible for them to be able to perform economic calculation in this kind of setting. So everybody obviously wants more security. So we have a police force, we have a town, everybody's paying for this police force. Now, how do we decide how we allocate this? First of all, how many police do we hire? And then how do we allocate them? Does every house get a policeman? Does every street get a policeman? Or does every person get a policeman? Or should only the rich people get police because they are the ones who have a lot of things to be stolen? They're the ones who have to be worried. So should all people pay taxes to have the police focus on protecting the rich because that's where the crime is going to go? Well, then why are the poor people paying taxes to protect the rich? Why shouldn't I get my own bodyguard? Just because I'm not rich doesn't mean I won't be subject to a crime someday, maybe. Why don't I get my bodyguard? There's no correct answer to all of these questions when you're answering them collectively because you don't have private property rights to be able to make economic calculation wherein I, as an individual, get to measure the trade-offs involved and decide. Now, if you took away all the money that all of the taxes that I paid for protection and you gave them to me, well, then I'm able to make that calculation. Then I can figure out how much does it cost to have a bodyguard and how much money do I have and how much do I value it? And do I want a bodyguard 24/7 or do I want it for a few hours? Or should I pool with my neighbors to get a guard for our neighborhood or our part of the neighborhood? Or should we have a patrol that patrols the whole neighborhood or something like that? All of these economic decisions can be made rationally if you have private property rights and if you're able to calculate resources. But if you have taxes being taken at gunpoint, where the alternative is you go to jail, and then you have somebody who ends up with all of that money, and then he has to make decisions, There's no rational basis for making them. And the result is, as we see, the U.S. spends billions, trillions of dollars murdering people in Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam and Gaza and all over the world. And Americans can't walk in Chicago, can't walk in the streets of Chicago or New York.
Well, you brought up Chicago a few times in the book, and my family's refugees from Chicago. I get it. Maybe we'll get into that in a little bit. And it's interesting with you think about Amazon on on a free money for market and what the market could produce for entrepreneurs, like what Amazon could do if it was getting real price signals in terms of money, like interest rates and things like that. And so when I think about Amazon on a Bitcoin standard, I don't think about Amazon stacking sats. I think about Amazon in a real world where people are thinking on a Bitcoin standard and everyone's using that. What kind of things we could get out of businesses that way? When you talk about sort of the private versus public sector for security, forced monopolies definitely lead to, deterioration in quality of delivery of services. And the public security, is there to protect and defend the state, not, the actual public people. And you think about all the private security making all this weaponry and all that's done and produced peacefully by peaceful people. That's kind of fascinating. So, and you mentioned centrally planning Estonia. So maybe we'll touch on that a little bit later. But how is the ownership of assets a social function?
Yeah, that's an important point that Mises makes in his book, which is that, Mises was writing in the middle of the 20th century, so about a century after the Marxist plague had hit humanity and created an enormous amount of brain damage all over the world where people started to regurgitate these idiotic ideas of Karl Marx. And one of these, or the main one, really, is just the vilification of capital owners. And this idea that if you have capital, then clearly you only are out there exploiting the workers because you don't work, and then all these people have to work hard, and then they work hard. And in order for them to work hard, they produce, they have to work hard to produce things, but you don't have to work hard. You're just sitting there and your capital is out there working and earning money for you. So clearly you're not working, so clearly you're exploiting them. And therefore, the best way to fix this is if we take all of the capital from the capital owners and give it to the workers who do the hard work, then the workers will stop getting robbed, and then everybody will become rich, and then everything will become abundant, and we will beat scarcity, and we would live in a world of magical unicorns flying everywhere, and everything will be sweet. That's essentially a slightly less dumb caricature of Marxism. If I tried to do it justice, it would come out even dumber than this. But that's essentially what Marxism is. And Mises, being Mises, of course, he just stands there and he says, no, you're all a bunch of socialists, as he is known to say. And he explains why, no, actually, owning capital is not this blessing. It's not like it is some kind of gift from God, that God just selects a bunch of people that become capitalists, and then everybody else has to work for them, and everybody else has to earn money everybody else has to work in order to earn money, whereas the capitalists continue to just get rich because they have the capital. Because what Marx misses is that the capital on its own is not productive. It requires somebody to know how to deploy it and how to put it to use. And the only way that you can maintain your capital, the only way that it can remain capital, is if you're able to employ it in a way that is productive. And by productive, we mean you buy things on the market that are subjectively valued by society overall at a price lower than the output that you produce them for. If you can't do that, if your inputs are more valuable to society than your outputs, if you spend $1 million a year producing things in order to then produce output that can only sell for $500,000, you're not going to have any more capital. You're going to run out of your capital. There is no fortune that is too big to be destroyed by economic misallocation. And so doesn't matter if Jeff Bezos, he's got how big is Amazon these days? Is it like hundreds of billions of dollars? Put an idiot in charge of Amazon and he will take it to zero. It's happened before. We've seen the biggest names in industries go down to zero. It has happened before. It will happen again. Yahoo used to be an enormous company, and it went practically to zero. And sometimes you don't even have to be an idiot. Sometimes it's just you don't do things correctly, not because it's, you know, you mismanage things. It's just somebody comes up with a better way of doing things, and then you become obsolete. So you need to constantly be running your capital effectively in the service of other people. That's the really cool part about it. It's not just you need to be running it for yourself. You need to be running it for other people. You need to be out there churning out widgets or shoes or clothes or food or whatever it is for people, and doing it by using resources that cost less than the output that you are producing. That's the only way that you can make this happen. And in order to do that, you need to get out there and figure out how to use your capital in the service of people. So it's a responsibility and a liability rather than just a gift. You can't just sit on your capital and continue to get rich. If you make mistakes with it, it will be gone. It will be eaten away. You know, you need to, if you're losing money on your business, you need to be constantly paying off all of your workers, paying all of your inputs. That's going to eat away at your capital stock. You're going to have to start selling some of your machines, selling some of your factories. And it doesn't matter how big of a business you start off with and how much of a capital endowment you have, it will dissipate if you don't run it in the service of others.
And kind of maybe the opposite of in the service of, how can value be lost through theft of, say, a family heirloom? Or like how is theft or vandalism, other forms of crime, similar to natural disasters and their economic effect?
Yeah, they're similar in that you're destroying the value that people have and you're taking it away. And I think the really the pernicious thing about it is not so much the theft itself. I think the worst thing about it is the impact that it'll have on people for the long term. And that the more you are a victim of theft, the more you expect to be a victim of theft into the future. So the less secure you are, the less you are going to prioritize the future, because the future becomes less and less certain. So it raises your time preference. And so if you want to see what causes people's time preference to decline, the process of civilization that we started discussing at the beginning of the chapter, beginning of this discussion, time preference declines when people get to live in periods of peace. If you're able to live for a long period of peace, then you start developing the security in your property, then you're able to invest in your property. But if you lived at a time and place where you don't have security of property and you think that your property is going to be lost at any point in time because somebody can come and take it, put a gun to your head and take it away from you, you have very little incentive to invest in your property. And so this is really what's so destructive about crime, and what's so hypocritical about people who think we don't need capitalism, we don't need property rights, property rights are not important. No, without property rights, without respecting property rights, we end up in conflict, and we end up in situations where people are just constantly at each other's throats. And that takes away from us something that is much more valuable than anything that we could fight about. The example that I like to give in the book is when I first, in chapter 9, when I first go from individual economizing to societal economizing, most econ textbooks follow this method, which is we look at the example of Robinson Crusoe, an individual on an island, and then another guy comes up. He runs into this other guy Friday. I think the best way to think of it is this. If they choose to cooperate with one another, then every day they can each specialize in doing the thing that they do more productively, the thing for which they have the lowest opportunity cost. And then that will result in both of them being able to increase their productivity, and it will increase their output. This is the benefit of trade. So you're good at fishing, I'm good at catching rabbits. If you and I cooperate, if you and I say, look, you focus on fishing, I'll focus on rabbits, we'll both end up with more fish and more rabbit every single day for the rest of our lives. If we fight, I could get your fish today, or you could get my rabbits today, and then you kill me or I kill you. And then for the rest of my life, I'm back to not benefiting from the division of labor. And that's just a simple example to look at it from the perspective of one individual, the two individuals. But really, if you're in a human society, if you're in the world today, that's, it's not just, you're not trading with one other person, you're trading with 8 billion people. Being able to be a civilized human being, respect other people's property, will prevent you from getting into conflict and will allow you to cooperate and join a division of labor of billions of people that's going to increase your productivity far, far, far more than anything that you can do on yourself. And that's really the real value of it. And that's why I think conflict is so ridiculous. And that's why I think property rights are so important, because anywhere in the world, you see, if property rights are respected, people are able to live peacefully, productively, cooperatively. When property rights are abused, when people don't respect each other's property rights, you just end up in a situation where conflict is eternal.
What I found interesting about the book, and I'd love to hear your take on, is the rights of succession and why it's so important to civilization and property rights. Because I could hear you thinking and talking about these things throughout the book. And, you know, like I was saying, there's just so much moral values and character embedded in the book. You know, I can't wait for my son to read it. He's 11. I think he's 12 or 13 guaranteed. I'm going to shove it in his face. And I want him to read it like every 10 years, because I wonder what a book like this would have, how would have resonated me in my teens and then even in my college years or my 20s or my 30s. And I'd love to see my own views, and I'll revisit a book, all your books, but I'd love to see my own views on them and learn new things as I go through life, because I'm sure I see this book differently as a father than I would as a young man. But this right to secession was very interesting. And I think just also speaks to a lot what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah. So from my perspective, I think of myself as an anarchist libertarian. In other words, I don't believe that any form of organization should be, anybody should be entered into any form of organization that is coercive. So you should not be part of anything that's coercive. And so that, for most anarchists and libertarians, means a rejection of the state and a rejection of the legitimacy of the state completely. And recently, I came across the work of Prince Hans Adam of Liechtenstein. And he is a fan of Austrian economics, and he is influenced by Mises. And he brings up this point on secession from Mises, which Mises mentioned, which I truly only appreciated after I got Hans Adam's perspective on it. When I first read it while reading Mises, Mises talking about secession, it seems like it's a niche case, if you may say, that, if Catalonia wants to secede from Spain, then if you're a libertarian, if you support property rights, if you support self-determination, then yeah, Catalonia, you should support Catalan independence. But I think it's a much more profound point that goes to the heart of what a state is. And in Prince Hans Adam's idea is that as humanity is becoming more and more liberated, as humanity is becoming freer and freer because we are advancing, our productivity is going up, our living standards are going up, people are able to provide for themselves more effectively, and that makes them more intellectually developed and therefore more difficult to rule and enslave, we need to find organizations, forms of organization that allow us more room for freedom. And what Prince Hans Adam presents is his idea of what the state should be in the third millennium. It's the opposite of the direction that we see the states taking in the 20th century. So in the 20th century, you go, and you see this all over the world, that the emphasis is on participation in the government process. So you want more people involved in how the decisions are taken. You want democracy. You want more voting. You want more parliament. You want more oversight by the parliament, more oversight by the people on the parliament, and the parliament over the government, and the government over all different branches of the government. And you want to make sure that each branch of the government doesn't have ultimate control. So there's checks and balances between the judicial and executive and legislative branches. And so you keep diffusing power in that way to ensure that you don't get totalitarianism. And Prince Hans Adam's perspective, which is also Mises' perspective, is that you don't want that. You want more power in the hand of the executive so that the executive can act coherently. But the check on tyranny is not giving people a vote where they get to choose between Muppet in red and a Muppet in blue. once every 4 years and then feel good about themselves. You give people the right to exit. You give people the right to secede down to the local neighborhood. We don't want to be part of your government anymore. We don't want to pay taxes and we don't want to get your services. And this is actually really quite mind-blowing when you think about it, because this is exactly how we get nice things in everything. The reason that you have a nice iPhone is not because you are taking part in the iPhone design process. You don't get to vote for Apple engineers. You don't get to vote for Apple CEO. You don't get to have any opinion. Apple doesn't even do customer surveys, as far as I can tell. Like most successful companies, they rarely ever ask you for your feedback. They know how to get the feedback that matters. And the most important feedback, of course, is the money. Are you paying or not? And this process gives the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook right now, or Steve Jobs before him, he has absolute power over Apple. He's a complete king. He can fire anybody. He can hire anybody. There is no limit to his power on the production process. Obviously, he can't put people to death. But there are some limits on his power. But in terms of the economic power that he has complete total power on Apple. He could shut down their phone division tomorrow if he decides. And he has all of this complete power. But what do you as a customer have? Nothing except the right to exit. You have the right to say, you know what? I don't like your new iPhone. I'm going to go buy the new Samsung Pro. And that's it. And that's what keeps him on his toes, because he needs to win your custom. He wins to win your revenues. And so in order to get that, he needs to stay on his toes. And that's why Samsung is also having to stay on its toes, because they're trying to get you from iPhone. And this is how everything gets built in the markets. We don't have a democratic process in the appointment of CEOs and in the engineering decisions. We have absolute power vested in the CEO. But the beneficiaries, the customers, have the right to exit. So imagine applying the same thing on the scale of government. Imagine how much more accountable your government would have to be when it doesn't anymore have to just play the stupid game of let's put these two identical people or two old senile people to trade insults at each other and then people pick. And of course, the people who are really in power stay in power, because I mean, as long as you don't have a chance to exit, it doesn't matter what happens with all of these voting exercises. If Apple was made into a government monopoly, wherein imagine the government says, you know what, Apple is the best iPhone smartphone maker. We're going to shut down Huawei. We're going to shut down Samsung. We're going to shut down all the other cell phone makers, and we're going to merge them all into Apple and have Tim Cook run all of that. I don't care how smart Tim Cook is. I don't care how smart Steve Jobs is. I don't care if you can reanimate Steve Jobs in his prime and bring him back to run the company. That company will go to shit within 5 years, like every single government monopoly goes to shit. Not because the people in charge are incompetent or evil, although that obviously helps if they are. But even if they're not, they can't do it if they're a government monopoly that forces you to buy their stuff, because they run out of market signals. They don't know if you like the new feature that they added, because it doesn't matter what you say. What matters is they need to have the ability to look at their customers dumping their machine and going to Samsung, because Samsung has this new little fancy thing that we didn't choose. And that's what's going to give them the idea that, yep, we need to move away from the thing that we have to the thing that Samsung had. Having that constant process, constant feedback of the market, where people get to perform real economic calculation over their goods that they're purchasing and decide between, I want to be with Samsung or I want to be with Apple. That's what gives Apple and Samsung the ability to improve their product and constantly continue to provide good products. And of course, there's no guarantee that they will. One day, Apple is going to likely lose its magic edge and it'll go out of business like so many other companies have gone out of business, most likely at some point, probably in our lifetime. But that's not the important thing, because when it goes out of business, whoever comes and replaces it is also going to be facing the same incentive, which is you have to meet those customers' demands or you go out of business. And that's what matters. Now, imagine if you apply that to a government. I think that would be quite good. I think that would really force government to get its act together. And what Prince Hans Adam says, and this is what he does and he practices in Liechtenstein. So in 2004 or 2005, I think, they had constitutional reform in Liechtenstein. It's one of the very few countries in the world where the constitutional reforms move away from giving more power to the parliament. In fact, they gave more power to the prince, which is the opposite of what's going on everywhere. Everywhere is leading to more democratization and more voting and more all of that stuff. When in Liechtenstein, they gave more power to the king. So the king has more and more power, but he grants people the right of secession. So people can just leave. So any local government area within Liechtenstein can choose to leave the country and join Switzerland or Austria or become independent if they want to. And so he can't keep them. So they can leave at the very small scale of, you know, effectively neighborhoods can leave the country. And I believe that's a much more efficient way of running governments. And I think naturally we're going to be tending toward that model over time. I think it's going to likely become more and more popular over time. I mean, it doesn't seem to be done much anywhere in the world because everybody seems to be stuck with these borders. You get born in this little part of the map and there's a line in the sand around it and there's a flag and there's a song and you just don't believe that you're stuck in it. And I think, you know, when we put central banks out of business, because central banks are the ones that are financing all of this song and dance, I think that's going to open people's minds up to considering whether, do we really need to be part of this gigantic institute, or could we maybe break out? Does Texas have to be part of the U.S.? Does every part of Texas have to be part of Texas? And I think the world would be a lot better if we, as Hans Hermann Hoppe, one of my favorite economists, puts it, what Europe needs is 500 Liechtensteins. It doesn't need one European Union. It needs 500 Liechtensteins. And I agree entirely. If you had every single small 50,000 people community united under one king, but with the right to exit and secede and join the king next door or join another king somewhere else, I think it would be a lot better because people would have the right to exit. And so then government would have to be responsible for its people, not responsible in the sense of you just get on TV and tell them to do what you said or deal with it, because then if they don't like you, they'll vote for the other guy like you who also works for the same people that have you in power. They'd have to be responsible in the sense that they would lose you as a customer. They'd lose all of the revenue that you bring in.
Yeah, I would add to, you know, around succession and even kings and with slaves and modern political entities and conflicts around the world is that, you know, if you control another people, you will never be free. And I remember just my youth, though, and I wasn't someone who acted out or was uncivilized, but if a teacher told me to believe something, I might think to myself, yeah, I'll write down what you need me to write on the test, but like, no, that's not right, or F that, or I'll question that. Or when I grow up, I don't see as much, like we talked about it maybe on the last show. I mean, maybe people think they're going to vote harder, you know, fiat man thinks he's going to vote harder, but I see more people rebel just in their minds and just opt out, you know, and you can do that with Bitcoin, maybe with money, but just in conversation or preference falsification. You talked a little bit about there with, you know, whether we'll see the emergence of more royal families built to withstand the test of time and control territories. Alex Fetsky was recently on the show, and I know he wants to reclaim Macedonia as a king and, you know, make it great again. And, you know, something that you brought up in the book, and we talked a little bit at the top of the show, you used the term decivilization. Maybe you could just expand a little bit about that, because that I hadn't really thought about that and whether that was a term or whether that could happen and what that would mean.
Yeah, so I think the process of civilization, as I discuss it in the book, and I draw on the work of Hoppe for this, is what happens, is initiated by the decline in time preference. So as people's time preference declines, people start prioritizing the future more. So they save more, they accumulate more capital, that increases their productivity, makes them more productive, which means they have a better standard of living, And then that allows them to start thinking more and more about the future, lowering the time preference further. And so the process of civilization, as we discussed at the beginning, is really a world in which children live lives that are better than what their fathers had. And if you have that, I mean, it sounds like such a superficial thing if you don't understand the economic infrastructure that's needed to deliver us to that point. But really, if you are able to have that generation after generation after generation, that necessarily implies that you've had a significant amount of peace, a significant amount of security of property, and a significant amount of division of labor, capital accumulation, and increasing utilization of energy sources and power sources to meet human needs. If you're able to pull that off, it's a very, very intricate dance. And most of human history is people inadvertently, magically coming across this magic formula for a couple of generations. And then the cycles of history are such that, you know, the first generation chances upon this formula out of just despair because they're poor, they're miserable, they don't have anything, and they figure out they need to work hard. So they develop a very hard work ethic to try and do this. The second generation is similar. The third generation starts to benefit from the abundance. And so it starts to take it for granted. It starts to not understand all of the values that went into it. It starts to think that the values that were necessary to have their parents give them a better life, they're just the quirks of old people. This is not something that matters to us anymore. We are more advanced than that stuff. And so they start denigrating these values and they start moving away from them. And then a couple of generations down the line, you get to the hedonists who don't think about the long term. And then that brings about the collapse of civilization. And so that's unfortunately a cycle that I think humanity has been stuck in for a very long time. And I think, sadly, we see signs that the 20th century is to a very large extent witnessed this process of de-civilization. We can see it in our rising time preference. People's time preference rises. You can see it in the decline of morality, increase in crime, in the decline of the family, in the prioritization of hedonism, satisfaction of immediate gratification, and satisfaction of our base instincts rather than trying to think about something more and more lofty. Where I think we're lucky is that we continue to accumulate technology through those things. So a lot of times a civilization comes along, it lasts for a couple of hundred years, they invent a few nice things, then they degenerate and decivilize and go back to the jungle. But the nice things that they invented carry on. Some people get them from their neighbors and then another civilization uses them and then it keeps carrying on. And I think, I mean, the optimistic thing, well, let's begin with the pessimistic thing. The pessimistic view, which is when in this book, I go through the process of civilization and explain how it happens and explain why it's a good thing. And then towards the end of the book, I explain, in chapters 13, 14, 15, go through the topic of money and how central banking is destroying money and how it is destroying the glue that holds the process of civilization together. Because if you don't have money, you don't have a market economy, you can't perform economic calculation, and then everything begins to fall apart. The last chapter is on civilization. I make the case for why you could be pessimistic about this, because with the money destroyed, we're witnessing every single building block of civilization being undermined, because you're destroying capitalism, you're destroying the ability to have a division of labor, and you're destroying the ability for people to defend themselves, because you are creating this gigantic army and police force that is at the mercy of governments and that is able to violate people's rights and therefore reduce people's security and therefore reduce people's time preference. So everything from security to property rights to division of labor to capital accumulation, all of that suffers when the money is being broken. And so there is plenty of room for pessimism there. We might be decivilizing, and we might live in a world in which our children are going to have a miserable existence compared to ours, and their children are going to have a worse existence. I think you see signs of this in the U.S. Quite clearly, not just the U.S., obviously, but I think the U.S. is the poster child because we have good data on the U.S., but it was a lot easier for people to own homes 40 years ago or something like that than it is now. It's a lot more expensive. And that's not just a coincidence, and it's not because houses are becoming more difficult to make. Mm-hmm. Houses are cheaper than ever for us to make, but it's because the money is broken, because money is completely destroying its ability of people to save. And that's what's driving that. So we could be quite pessimistic about it, but then there is room for optimism. And the room for optimism is, you guessed it, Bitcoin. So you could say that this whole book is a giant, elaborate, roundabout ad for Bitcoin. Would it entirely be an unfair criticism? I'd say there's a lot of substance in the ad, but I think ultimately, if you believe that the money is such a big decivilizing force, the fiat money is such a big decivilizing force, and that's the topic of my second book, the fiat standard is the debt slavery alternative to human civilization, really is the decivilizing force of our time, then in this book, I discuss technology. There's a whole chapter on technology and how technology is such a powerful way for us to economize, because it's a form of capital that is immaterial, that does not depreciate, and that is not scarce and not rival, and so therefore it can be copied endlessly. And I argue that software is the most productive form of capital, because it's just purely ideas and it can increase productivity massively, and that's why software is eating the world. And so the optimism comes from the fact that capitalism always wins, because even individual capitalists might lose, and individual people who might be capitalists might give up on capitalism and turn into socialists. But ultimately, capitalism has to win, because capitalism is the only way for mobilizing human rationality in a productive way. It's the only way for organizing human rationality in a way that is productive and in a way that yields fruits for us. And if you destroy capitalism, you destroy your ability to benefit from capitalism, but you give an advantage to people who continue to use capital. And so I think what's happening now is that, thanks to the computer revolution, thanks to the fact that we have computers, thanks to the fact that we have the internet, thanks to the fact that we have software, we can transcend fiat money. We can transcend the decivilizing swamp of fiat that is sucking us in, the quicksand effectively that is drawing us in. We can rise above that, because we can hitch our economic wagon onto the digital economy that is a lot freer, that has a hard money, that allows us to save, that allows us to prioritize the future, that allows us to think of the future, that allows us to lower our time preference, allows us to spend and send money all over the world, allows us to engage in the division of labor, and allows us to stop getting robbed to finance governments. And this really might be why I think Bitcoin is such a civilizationally momentous invention, because it's likely going to be the thing that prevents us from decivilizing because of fiat money.
Well, I only have two questions. I have millions of questions, but we'll hope to squeeze in two. Do you think Bitcoin will be remembered as our age's most significant civilization achievement?
Yeah, I mean, if it sticks around and if it outlives fiat money, then yeah, it'll be the most significant thing.
I want to read from page 389 from your book. So, building on what you said about technology and software, because there are preceding paragraphs about that here. You're right. In the same way human reason moved us from using slaves to horses to cars to sophisticated supersonic jets, and moved us from using human messengers to carrier pigeons to paper mail to email to video calls, It is now moving us away from relying on monopoly central banks to reliable open source software. Humans have reason, and it is reason that has taken us out of the caves and allowed us to conquer our environment, tame the wildest beasts, and live longer and better. The current parasitic governmental banking monopoly is just another in the long list of challenges human reason has faced, and Bitcoin may prove to be the device our reason concocts for conquering it. With transparent rules available for anyone in the world to audit, and with a system built entirely on verification rather than authority, Bitcoin gives the entire world a monetary market commodity that works without needing coercive political authority. It allows us to make peaceful non-aggression the basis of human economic interaction, bringing the productivity of the market system to the monetary realm, reversing the violent high-time preference status fiat detour of the last century. If it can unleash human civilization from the clasp of the state's fiat claws, Bitcoin will be remembered as our age's most significant civilizational achievement. What I love about your writing is it's such a great book about Bitcoin because it doesn't mention Bitcoin till like literally the last two paragraphs. Maybe it comes up for smidgen in money to point out what Bitcoin is and how useful and just acknowledge it and reckon with it. It's a tremendous piece of work, very seminal. And so my final question to you is, you know, we've discussed how important family is to civilization and having kids and what does it do to one's time preference. So did you always know that? Is that something you learned from your father? The way this book felt like a tomb being passed from father to son to father to son? Or is that something you maybe learned after getting married and having kids? And what advice would you give to people about family?
I mean, it's something that my father told me, but it's not something that I took very seriously when I was young. I was a very fiat person, and so there's a extreme level of high time preference that I suffered from. So I'd say in my 20s, I was pretty high time preference, and I was just not really, I did not appreciate family and marriage from that perspective. And it was up until I got into my 30s that I started to think about those things more seriously. I think learning economics and learning Austrian economics definitely helped. Like, it helped me develop a much more mature outlook on life. And then eventually, that's when the things that my dad used to tell me as a kid started to make sense. And you realize, oh, he's not just an old man who's saying old things. Some of this stuff actually makes sense. And I think, soon after that, I did get married and coming up on 10 years of marriage very soon. I think it's a good idea. I don't regret it. I've been happily married, and I think it's, I highly recommend it. I think it's, after a certain point, I remember my grandmother just telling me that, look, after a certain point in your life, you cannot really function in society as a single person. You have to be part of a couple. And it's just people get sorted into couples and you don't want to be the odd one out. I mean, clearly that's probably different now because a lot fewer people are getting married now. So, but I could see the idea that it's just, I think it's fun being when you're in college, when you're young in school. It makes sense that every person is on their own and people are just living in this kind of social circles where it's normal for people to be alone. But I think as people grow, you need companionship. You need to be part of society in a way in which you're part of a stable relationship. It just makes dealing with one another a lot more predictable and it's just, I think, a healthy part of maturing. And I think, of course, it's on a personal level, I think it's essential because, I mean, look, as human beings, we cannot survive on our own when we're born, and we cannot survive on our own in our old age. We need help on both of those stages. And that's just the way that life is. Life is this force that is constantly pushing you and driving you to want to recreate, to procreate. You're constantly if you're not married, if you don't have kids, you are constantly driven by that force inside you, and it's you have to get married to realize just how different it is, I guess. After you have kids, you realize that, yeah, everything that I used to do before was just that force inside me that wants to reproduce is out, is controlling me and is driving me toward trying to reproduce. And you just, you can stay in denial about this. You can over philosophize it. You can go mad trying to fight with it, but that's just how you are. And this is life, because if that wasn't what life was, you wouldn't be here today. You are only here today because every single one of your ancestors, going back to God knows how many generations, every single one of those people had such a strong drive inside them to procreate that they managed to do it, and managed to do it well enough that their own child managed to grow up enough to reproduce, and to have somebody who managed to grow up old enough to reproduce, and have somebody, every single one. So it's a real miracle that every single one of those people managed to do that. And that's why you're here now. And I think it's stupid and futile to try and fight that. I think this idea that, oh no, I'm different, you know, because we have, I don't know, cars and TV and TikTok, we are going to be different than every single generation of humans that has ever existed, and I'm going to be satisfied with not doing this. I think the healthy thing to do is to just understand that this force is within you, and to understand that you are going to be a lot happier if you yield to it. I think this is really the key thing. Like, if you just accept that this is the thing, and then start living your life based on the idea that you want to yield to it, it offers you so much clarity and so much direction in your life. You know, once you've directed your life toward, all right, this seems like a simple thing, I just need to impregnate someone and then have a child come out. Well, no, it's not such a simple thing. You have to live your entire life in a way to make that thing happen, so that the child grows up and has a chance to then do the same thing himself. Well, you need to find the right person. You need to, more important than finding the right person, of course, is being the right person. And simply just having this as a goal is the North Star of getting your life in order. Having this as a goal fixes everything. And not having it as a goal leaves you lost and confused. And I speak from personal experience, and I also see this in a lot of people, that if you don't think of this as being something important, if you're just putting it off, because most of us just are, we're conditioned socially to just forget about this. People say that society is constantly pressuring you to get married. It's the other way around. Society is constantly dangling shiny new things in front of you and telling you, hey, you know, forget about marriage and having kids. Just indulge in this thing. And so you could waste your life chasing after fleeting pleasures, which as you grow older become less and less interesting and less rewarding and less meaningful. So there was a time in which watching Hulk Hogan and WWF was the height of excitement for me. And then as you grow older, you know, you replace that with other more interesting things. But the same thing happens. All the fun things that you're doing in your 20s that you think of as being the most amazing things, there's only so much you can do. There's only so much partying or whatever, or whatever hobbies you have. There's only so much of that that you can do without it getting boring and tedious. And the thing that actually provides lasting meaning is seeing your children grow. It's essentially giving yourself a taste of immortality, because your child, after all, is a part of you. It's literally a physical part of you. I mean, not to get too visual in the biology of it, but I presume all your listeners are familiar with what's going on. But it is literally a part of you and of your wife that survives you and lives on after you. And if you do your job well, they'll be able to have more kids that will survive him, and then they'll have more kids. Effectively, you're getting a shot at eternity by being able to raise a family and have children. You're allowing a part of you to continue to survive. And this is, I believe, a very, very good way to approach life. And this is why I call it, and to go back to how we started off this discussion, this is why I call it the most important lesson in this book, because you read this book and you come to the conclusion, all right, I'm sold. I want to do this civilization thing. So how do I do this civilization thing? And on a personal level, on a personal, functional, actionable level, you do this by starting a family and having a family and trying to give your child a life that's better than yours. If you make that your goal, I believe everything else falls into place.
Wow, that's incredible. Congratulations on the almost anniversary. My wife and I, we just celebrated our 12th. A lot of what you said there really resonates. You know, I think, you know, your life partner, it's a kind of, it's your first one-way lifelong trade. It's kind of like your first Bitcoin. A lot of what you talked about there was, you know, the law of attraction. But, you know, I think you compare marriage a lot to Bitcoin in the sense that, you know, marriage is humbling. You have to submit. You have to compromise. You have to relearn a lot of things. But, you know, I love being married. I used to have an accounting professor who would joke a lot about the economics of marriage. He said he used to, when he proposed, they were going to get married on January 1st. And, you know, like a month before the wedding, he was like, well, we got to move the wedding date. And she was, you know, she got worried, you know, he wanted to delay. And he's like, no, we got to move it up to December 31st. I want to get the tax deduction for the whole year, you know. And he always tried to have his kids at the end of the year so we can get the full. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And I think he just liked the jokes. But Saifedean, this has been tremendous. So dope as always. You know, you brought up Chicago and Law and Order in America. I think we could do a whole show riffing on that. But we've never done the Bitcoin standard. We've done the fiat standard and the principles of economics. So, you know, you have an invitation to come back. I'd love to get this done this year sometime.
Yes, let's definitely do it. I enjoy these conversations a lot. You're one of my favorites.
So appreciate that.
You actually go through the book and like you know how to ask questions about random obscure passages in the middle of the book, which doesn't happen often. Most interviewers are just like, so you wrote a book, what's it about?
Well, thank you for that. I love your work, and I love putting in the work to get to the show, and that's my joy. So I appreciate you putting out these tremendous tombs. All three of them are, you know, works of a lifetime. I can't wait to see what you do next, and I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you and your work.
Thank you so much. My website, saifedean.com, I'm teaching a course based on this book on principles of economics right now. So it's been running throughout the academic year. It's about halfway through, so you can come sign up and join us. The course is posted online, one lecture every 2 weeks, and then we have a discussion seminar once every week where we discuss these things live, different time zones each week so that everybody can join. So 12 hours apart on alternating weeks. So you can join from anywhere in the world. This is going to be a suitable time for you, hopefully. And I am on Twitter, where I'm constantly always having very strong opinions about a few topics that I happen to be paying attention to. And also my new website, thesafehouse.com, where you can buy my books as well as Parker Lewis's new book, Gradually Then Suddenly, and Lynn Alden's new book, Broken Money, and Fiat Food, a book that I helped co-author on the topic of food related to the Fiat Standard, really a spin-off from the Fiat Standard, written by Matt Ulisiak, an investigative study of Fiat Food. So you can buy these, all of them, in cloth hardcover, beautiful cloth hardcover books. You can get them from thesafehouse.com. I think that's it. Thank you.
Awesome. Sir. Thank you so much, Saif. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.